and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. This podcast is brought to you by Texas Citizens Bank. Through good and tough times, you need a bank that will stand by you. Texas Citizens Bank gives Houston small and medium-sized businesses the resources they need to thrive. As one customer says, a huge thank you to our friends at Texas Citizens Bank. Great customer service and down-to-earth good people. Call 713-948-5700 to learn more today. My guest for this episode is James Hurry, the Deputy Director and Chief Innovation Officer at the Translational Research Institution for Space Health, or TRISH, which is based here in Houston, Texas, and supports research and technology development in the world of space health. James and I will discuss TRISH's role in space commercialization and the unique research the organization is supporting. Hi, James. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Natalie. Very much looking forward to talking about space and space health and everything we're going to cover.
Absolutely. Going to be a really great conversation about everyone's favorite topic, space and health and space health and the very unique Houston element to it. So, of course, we've had Dorit on the podcast before, but for those who are unfamiliar with TRISH and specifically what you do for the organization, I want to give you an opportunity to share.
Absolutely. So the Translational Research Institute for Space Health is a collaborative with the a collaborative agreement with NASA's Human Research Program, which is based here at Johnson Space Center here in Houston. And that is the group that actually focuses on all of the health support for both the astronauts, the astronaut corps, as well as the flight surgeons and all of the infrastructure that supports a healthy and productive flight for every one of NASA's flights. TRISH is actually empowered with looking for the best health and human performance technologies that can advance NASA's flights, not just in the short term with the Artemis missions, but also in the long term. So including the Mars missions and the missions that will round out the 2020s as well as the 2030s. So we're looking for things that are ahead of the market, things that are still coming to market, but are still in an early stage of development. And things where there's still a proof of concept or a validation process that that TRISH can potentially fund and help mature as that information or technology gets incorporated into NASA's future flight operations. And that's our kind of core function, which is providing federal grants to both disruptive ideas as well as translational ideas, some of which are academic in nature and some of which are based in companies. And I lead the industry program, which focuses on the more translational aspects, the more mature aspects that can potentially be incorporated into NASA's more immediate flights. And so that's kind of the big picture. And most recently, we have also taken on supporting commercial spaceflight, which I think we're going to talk about a lot more. The commercial spaceflight efforts involve any number of carriers, but they started with the Inspiration 4 flight that happened last week, which is the all civilian crew that flew that lifted off from Kennedy Space Center on Wednesday and landed back again over the weekend. This involved four members that were raising money for the St. Jude's Children's Cancer efforts. And we provided the research and support for that flight in the way of lining up the IRB, which is one of the research governance documents, as well as the technology and helping the SpaceX engineers review all of the experiments and incorporate those into the payload and then get consent from the crew. And then we'll house all the data after the flight. And so my particular role in this as the deputy director and chief innovation officer, again, I lead certain parts of the program, such as the industry program. And then I also help maintain all of our ongoing solicitations. So the staff basically executes on all of the grants that we'll be putting out. And I kind of align the different mechanisms so that we make sure we hit our goals as an institution on a year-by-year basis. But then in this particular flight, I worked mostly on all of the agreements involving the different entities, and then also helped put the database in place so that our database can actually handle not just clinical data, but also research data and can actually be flexible for any way that we grow in the future. So kind of a wide variety of things. It's definitely a job that wears many hats, but we're an institution that goes in a number of directions. And so that's actually kind of one of the exciting parts about the job.
So you've noted already on this, but it is, a very interesting time in space exploration with the commercialization of space. It's more power players at the table than just, NASA. executing these missions. So what does that specifically mean for Trish, and what's the role Trish is going to play in, as this commercialization continues to develop?
So great question. The first thing I would say is the exciting part about this is more people in space. More people flying, which means more ways for us to learn from all the people that fly. So if you look at the total number of people that have flown in space, they've all been, in essence, up until this, at least mostly in, up until this point, have been employees of nations. They've been astronauts from different governments, and they're heavily pre-screened. And it's a very competitive deal to get on one of these flights. And it is the culmination of their careers and all of their efforts on day-to-day training for years and years and years. And they really are, you know, amazing people that represent us in so many great ways. In doing that, you have something like 500 people that that we have some amount of information on going all the way back to the 60s. And 500 is not a huge amount of data when you consider large health systems or large insurance companies that cover hundreds of thousands or millions of lives. And you really need to get to the volume of data before you start to see things like outliers and start to see trends. And so what's really useful about this is that this is going to increase the number of people actually flying on a year-by-year basis for the next several years, and actually get us more data points. And also, more interestingly, it's going to bring in people that aren't as heavily pre-screened. So you're going to start to get whoever's check clears, which means you're going to start to get people of all different ages. You're going to get people with all different kinds of background conditions. You're going to get these systems, these different human systems that are going to be stressed in new ways. And that's going to really teach us more on a number of different ways. And so we're excited because this will give us much more data in order to potentially help NASA tackle things that may involve the Artemis missions and the Mars missions. For our role in this, since we are funded by NASA and since we are basically one of the entities that will tie into several of these flights, we have the ability actually to measure several different experiments across several different platforms and several different carriers. The result of that will be that this data won't be fragmented and it won't be unusable. It'll actually be structured and it'll be housed in one system and it'll be accessible by the space health research community, which means that insights can be developed not just from the few people that might have access to a small proprietary system for each carrier, but instead, you know, anybody that has this zeal for space can potentially access, if they have the right credentials and they go through the right process, which, you know, we're putting in place, that security be maintained and that these folks will be able to publish and work on the greater human knowledge, then hopefully this entire endeavor will advance human interest in space and confidence in space, you know, for the next several decades. This is kind of foundational work that will allow new questions to be asked over new populations, and then try to make that experience of space and that knowledge of space accessible to all of humankind. And I don't think that could be done if a particular for-profit entity or if any of the carriers tried to do it themselves. I think you'd get a fragmented picture, you'd get something that would be used for marketing material. But the fact that we're approaching this from a harmonizing perspective means that I think we'll be able to set this up in a way that allows all of humanity to benefit, which is one of the things that we find really exciting about not just these flights, but, you know, all future flights. The more, the better.
Yeah, that's such an interesting point, too, that, you know, just every person who leaves Earth and headed for space becomes another example, another, you know, data point in expanding this research. So that's really interesting. I wonder, you know, how both currently and in the future, you've talked a little bit about how Trish works with both NASA and these for-profit companies, but how do you see that relationship developing as, you know, there's more and more of these, you know, missions that are going to space, both with NASA and with these for-profit companies? It seems like it's the constant, you know, across the board to be able to partner with these different companies.
So it's a little still bit of an unknown. So we're in new territory, but the NASA interests and needs are defined in their red risks and are the research that involves things like the International Space Station standard measures. This is the knowledge that NASA's building over its astronaut base, and we have the ability to actually add some to that within those standards. But when you get outside of those standards, when you get out of the things that NASA has identified as being their clear priorities for humans to inhabit space, then you start to get into a bit of the unknown, and that's where the companies will be pushing projects or experiments that would help their path to market but may not help NASA. And that's where Trish has the ability to not only help push the things that work with NASA and fund those things, but also to potentially incorporate some of the technologies that, you know, we may not have considered to be useful for NASA. And that might involve any one of these passengers that cooperate with like an academic institution. A number of the research institutions are working with several of these future passengers about potential technologies they're either developing in-house or they're partnering with like med tech developers or therapeutic companies. And so there's the possibility there for something unexpected to potentially help not just on those flights, but also on our total knowledge base and provide some way for NASA to benefit with something they didn't know to ask for. And so that unknown is one of the areas where we think commercial spaceflight might fill new information and provide new insights because they simply weren't on our radar. And that would be driven by just some part of North American innovation or research that that thinks it would apply to space, and then we'll, you know, provide the support in order to get all of that flight certified and get it all so that it'll actually work in a defined way in a microgravity environment, and then also do all things like the consent and the IRB so that it's not harming anybody, and the end result will hopefully be, you know, usable information from potentially not just NASA sources but outside sources as well.
Yeah, I wonder if we can talk a little bit more specifically about the type of research and the type of technology that, you know, is benefiting from Trish, because, you know, when you think about the abstract of space health, what does that really mean? What types of technology and research is Trish, you know, supporting that's really going to make an impact on the commercialization of space, the future of space in general?
So, you know, up until this last year, we had been heavily focused on the Mars missions. And it actually is a whole lot of fun when you think about providing healthcare in a very remote environment, 2.5 year-long missions, which means very little resupply, minimal mass, power, and volume, almost impossible healthcare without the ability to access an ER or even an expert or flight surgeon or physician without something like a 20-minute turnaround time with regards to the data. So you'd ask a question and 40 minutes later, you'll get a response. So we jokingly say we're looking for perfect healthcare in your pocket when we're talking about the Mars missions, because we're looking for what the future of healthcare will be in remote places on Earth, where it is difficult to actually staff things like physicians and infrastructure, but you still have people that have need. And so in that environment, we've been looking at things like an example on our last cycle would be metabolism, but metabolism that can be lowered to the point of something like suspended animation. It does, you know, bridge often possibly into something like science fiction. This is something you've seen on pretty much every science fiction TV show or movie you've ever seen about the future of space. But there isn't really a need to put somebody in some kind of cryostasis for what would amount to an 8-month mission or an 8-month journey to Mars. That's something that you would do if you were doing, you know, years and years of some kind of cryosleep or something, and we're nowhere near that. But at the same time, if we can find a way to actually lower metabolism and learn from other species that to some extent hibernate for long periods of time, then we can lower the amount of food intake we might need for our astronauts. We can lower the amount of water or things like oxygen or the carbon cycle, and potentially manage things like waste, and just basically keep the human a little more manageable with lower resources and possibly less physiological risk over a longer period of time. And so that's just worth exploring. And so that's where Trish goes into the areas that are based in rigorous science, but at the same time are leaps. And so we've been encouraged by the Human Research Program to try to take those leaps whenever we can find them. And so that's one kind of arm of what Trish has been doing, and that has been a heavy focus on kind of the Mars missions for a number of years. We have recently been focused on the Artemis missions. So how can we help a number of astronauts on the moon for a shorter duration mission? So these missions would likely be something along the lines of, 7 to 21 days or possibly longer, but given the amount of radiation that may be received on the moon, unless there are something like a subterranean living condition, it would be hard for somebody to actually maintain a residence around the moon for an extended period of time, unless we have some kind of shielding advances that we currently don't have. But in that environment, you actually don't have nearly the constraints you do for the Mars mission. So you have, in essence, the ability to return home relatively quickly, relatively quickly being maybe a couple of days as opposed to 8 months, which means if you have some kind of medical issue, you have the ability to either resupply, get immediate data support, or evac somebody back to Earth in a relatively manageable timeframe. And so in that environment, we're looking at how we can continue to augment not just support, but also medical support and then helping them achieve the level of medical care they want in an environment where, you can't do things like MRIs or CT scans. You can't do things like surgery because of the, microgravity and the possibility of fluids going in a wide variety of areas. So some of the things that we just take for granted as just something you could do in an urgent care center here on Earth are things that aren't necessarily doable in a remote environment in microgravity. But the more that we learn about that, the more we can do. So we're going to be focused more on things that actually have immediate need for that kind of shorter duration mission. Again, on the International Space Station, it's even shorter than that, which means if there isn't a medical emergency, you can have somebody back here on Earth, I think, within 3 to 5 hours, depending upon, where things are. But that's pretty quick. And so in that environment, anything that has any kind of significant concern can be returned very fast. And so, as far as Trish goes, we're looking to learn from both near and far, and we're really focusing on the kind of medical needs that are evolving in the lunar environment, and then how they might also apply to the commercial spaceflight environment as a training ground for tech validation and knowledge development.
I think it's so interesting because when you think about those future-facing, research projects, it is our comparison is this sci-fi element, but that's your actual reality down the road, addressing these needs. But at the same time, some of the other challenges, as you mentioned, regarding space health are actual challenges that, some areas have on Earth. It's really funny how that can be so future focused, but at the same time, parts can be super relatable. Like if you don't have access to, if you live in a remote area and you don't have access to that same level of healthcare, it's kind of the same as if you're in space on the ISS.
Yeah. And so this last cycle, we actually were looking at technologies that would help behavioral health and cognitive performance for the industry program. And that's actually something that affects us all. And it especially was relevant during the backdrop of the pandemic. So we actually had funding available for awards of up to $500,000 for technologies that help people deal with things like anxiety and isolation. And at that moment, almost everybody in the world was dealing with anxiety of isolation. and so, in those moments, you can really see that part of what we're trying to do with this healthcare is absolutely relevant on Earth, and might even involve any one of us. And so for us, it's trying to determine which of these medical needs overlap with large parts of the population now, and which parts of these needs are still further out and are a bit of a stretch for humanity. And what HRP does is allow us to take the risk to go after the things that aren't readily available with markets. Right now, if you want to bring med tech or health technology to market, you have to determine what the size of the market is and what the sales strategy is and what the price and what the profit margin would be. And that determines whether things get made or not. I say that from somebody who actually worked in pediatric innovation. So it was very hard to make those arguments in pediatric innovation that, you know, anything that you would bring to market would actually have a large return on investment. But they still needed to be made. And in this environment, we're able to take a little risk and fund things that don't necessarily have a defined market, but that might have some kind of significant impact over a large base in the future. And we can be a part of helping that to become more defined and therefore more attractive for follow-on investors, other stakeholders. In this behavioral health and cognitive performance solicitation, we actually had groups like Anthem participating and groups like AARP, because they actually are also looking at what they can fund in those areas and what technologies they can move to market that will help their population bases. And that just seemed like a very good tie-in, not only to what we need, but what they need, advancing not just our knowledge in space, but also advancing the tools and possible technologies that could meet the needs of actual people here on Earth as well.
It's interesting just because I think people forget about that element of space research, that it can really have this human and Earth role. I mean, NASA for years, so much interesting technology originated from NASA, and it kind of has nothing to do with space, but NASA was addressing a specific challenge regarding their space explorations and their missions, and that technology translates to something relevant on Earth too. So it's, we forget that, you know, there's so much opportunity with space innovation. So I want to talk a little bit more about Inspiration 4, which you mentioned earlier, that involved civilians going up to space on a SpaceX, you know, vehicle, really cool collaboration and a really big moment, I think, for the commercialization of space. So I want to know kind of from your perspective, you know, there's only going to be more of these types of missions, and Trish did play a role in that, which is really cool to see. So in regard to that, tell me a little bit about what the impact of that trip and that mission meant for Trish.
Sure. So we actually started by proposing 10 experiments. We ended up getting, I think, 6 approved. One ended up not being actually ready for flight during the window when needed for all of the education. And the last ended up having a technology problem. So we went from 10 to actually 4. And then for future flights, we'll be again proposing a larger menu. And part of what we're trying to do with aligning with stakeholders and with other potential outside parties would be to expand that experiment range, not just from the things we funded for things like Mars and Artemis, but also things that may have relevance in other ways. And so we want to expand this menu quite a bit into several different aspects that that each actual crew will have the ultimate say in what they fly and what they don't fly. And that's one of, I guess, the key points is we actually don't dictate exactly what happens on a flight. The crew itself says, this is something I identify with, and this is something that I think actually can help humanity. And in this instance, this crew within the Inspiration 4 flight with Jared Isaacman and his 3 participants and passengers actually consented and agreed to work on all 4 experiments. And so those 4 experiments actually had a variety of different outcomes. So, you know, for one thing, was neurovestibular research, which is done by Dr. Shellhammer at Johns Hopkins. And this is important because humans were built to live on Earth. They're built to live on 1 gravity environments. And whenever you get into space or the moon, you're going to have the body compensate and change. And there's going to be some aspect of motion sickness or nausea or even disorienting or debilitation. You'll see this on the astronauts when they return back to Earth. They stumble to some extent. They take some amount of time to get reoriented to 1 gravity. And so the more we can learn about pre and post flight information and even in-flight assessment, as the body adjusts over a 3-day or a 7-day or a 10-day flight, the more we'll learn to how, you know, the structures in the ears and the actual orientation of the mind, how that all can be something we can potentially mitigate or manage in the future. It is a concern for even something like the moon mission, but obviously it would be a major concern for flying 8 months to Mars and then not being able to stand on Mars. That would be a major concern. So that's one of the experiments. Also, one of the experiments involves the butterfly IQ system, which is a fascinating leap forward. There are reference models of ultrasound systems, but the butterfly system really democratizes ultrasound, and it's getting widespread adoption in North America. We identified it 3 or 4 years ago as a technology that really could help humanity. And so we've actually flown it on the International Space Station and are now also flying it here for these experiments. And this allows this handheld portable IQ ultrasound system to look at a number of different parts of the anatomy, including neck veins, the eye, the gallbladder, the urinary bladder, and then to kind of compare how those structures will change in flight so that we can see what it looked like before flight and in flight and after flight. And so that, you know, that is utilizing new technology that can help set a standard in space and something we're really excited about. And we want to continue to see the Butterfly IQ system get more and more traction in space. Another one would be neurocognitive performance, and that's being done by Dr. Basner over in University of Penn Medical College. And that involves a number of assessments that the crew will take that just keeps track of how they're performing in a microgravity environment. One of the things that possibly happens to an astronaut or a space participant is loosely described as kind of the space stupids or some kind of impairment where, you know, disorientation or the effects of microgravity and the fluid shifts result in some kind of cognitive impairment. And it's usually very small. It's usually not a major concern. It is something that is just a part of being in space. But experiments like this will allow us to understand how each one of these passengers were impacted. And the more of that we can learn on a personalized basis, the more we can actually learn on what may be, again, the outliers on cognitive performance on short or longer term visions. So that's one of the things that we think is also going to be a major need for, you know, several flights as well. And then also we're doing some amount of in-flight blood and saliva analysis, and that's being done by Dr. Zinhausen at the University of Arizona. And he has identified a vertical flow immunoassay platform, which allows for basically both saliva and blood spot analysis. And that will actually help to determine what the results are in flight. So we're excited about that. And then also when it downloads and is analyzed when they're back down on Earth. But that is another piece of technology that that will allow for more samples to be accepted. And then also those samples will be incorporated into the biobank that is being developed for these flights as well. So those are the four experiments that in essence are testing different parts, and each of them will not just, you know, give us information for this one particular flight, but I think all four of these will actually be recreated for future flights as well. So we'll not just get to see the results of this flight, but we'll compare the results of this flight to several other flights at the International Space Station, even possibly into the lunar activities. And from there, we'll hopefully be able to see patterns. And then, you know, again, all of this is actually being integrated into a system that's being put in place here at Baylor College of Medicine. This database is actually a system that is both HIPAA compliant and GDPR compliant. So we can handle both clinical data as well as research data. And in that process, we actually reviewed 26 different systems with a wide variety of technical capabilities, everything from health information exchanges to EMRs to experimental systems to clinical trial systems. And we ended up settling on a clinical trial system that is very, very flexible and very, very adaptive. And it'll allow us to actually segment flights and record information with different carriers and different aspects of every single flight. Really complicated, but the ability for us to actually capture all information in a way that, again, can be additive for future analysis and for the space health community.
Yeah. And so something that will also continue to go on after this mission is the new EXPAND program, which I think is relevant to everything you were just talking about too. So I wonder if you can explain a little bit about the impact that new program, which was just announced and I covered on Innovation Map. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Absolutely. So this is just the first flight of the EXPAND program. And the reason it's called the EXPAND program is because we're expanding the number of people that are flying into space and that will have, you know, expanded information. But the EXPAND program also involves not just the commercial spaceflight activities, but also analogs that we tie into, including this Australian Antarctic Division partnership that is being developed between Trish and the Human Research Program and the Australian Antarctic Division, which is an analog down in Antarctica, as you'd expect, it's in the name, where they have very remote healthcare, people that actually are cut off from resupply and support for months at a time because of incredible weather conditions. And the medical care and support they can get and the data they've accumulated over, I think, decades of unusual situations, unusual conditions. And so we'll be testing mental health technologies down there because of the participants being so remote and being in an environment where they have, anxiety about resupply and potentially so many things that could go wrong. It's an area where we can test a number of things that can help us give insights and then from there fly them on the commercial space flight activities as a validation curve. But the EXPAND program is going to incorporate flights from all different carriers and again, feed into the database that we have built. And that program itself will continue to grow and grow as we have more and more passengers.
See, I think something that's, incredibly unique about Trish in this greater commercialization of space landscape and space in general, I guess, is this idea that space health is always going to be a part of the conversation. And whether it's billionaires going to space or a NASA mission, there's this constant and this opportunity to provide value and to the databases and the biobanks and EXPAND in general. So I guess, I know you want to speak to that and the commercialization greater picture. We're kind of mad at these billionaires that are going to space, right? Because we're like, why? And Trish provides that value, making kind of lemonade, I guess, out of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it also goes back to what you mentioned earlier about the, the advances that we've gained from actually trying to stretch into space. Right now, you have these large ticket prices. You have anywhere from $25 to $50 million per seat in order to fly from something like 3 days to 12 days in space. And if that person were to just sit out the window, then that would be just a very expensive consumption trip that would be a human experience. And if they have the ability to pay for that, then obviously they have the ability to enjoy it as much as they'd like. But one of the kind of recent developments is that the FAA has actually stated that if you're going to get your wings for flying in space, you can't just go, but you also have to do something that helps humanity. And we make the argument that if you are willing to go and to actually help participate in some of this experimentation, some of these research endeavors, then you actually are not just sharing your experience with space, because we really hope everyone is able to do that well, but also to gain knowledge for all of humankind. And in that way, we're not just advancing the technology and knowledge base, but we're also tying in new people and to a certain extent democratizing space more than it has been in the past. In the past, you actually had to fit a very concise criteria, and you had to beat out a number of other superhumans in order to get a ticket and a ride. But now, if you have the means and you're able to plan to some extent, if you're able to line up that kind of money, either from yourself or from others, and so that we're looking for things like crowdsourcing or fundraising efforts to where a number of people can be flown that may not have to or may not have access to something like $50 million themselves, but they also may advance knowledge as well. And one of the flights we're looking at next year actually would involve flying a physician that'll experiment on himself in flight, and in doing so, he'll get actually either a discounted ticket or we'll actually fundraise to help make that flight happen, because the knowledge is worth the difference between the ticket price and what we have to raise. So the point is now the knowledge gained actually helps mitigate some of the costs associated, and it actually makes it something interesting for all of us to try to put some amount of effort into, or funding, either taxpayer dollars or philanthropy dollars or alternate revenue streams, something that actually can get some people to space that can advance all of us instead of just joyride. And joyriding is going to happen, and even in that environment, those folks are still going to probably participate in a meaningful way. But we're looking for ways for deeper support, and we'll try to facilitate that as much as humanly possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's the marriage of space tourism and you know, what NASA's been doing for years. So I think that's really important. And it makes sense because, you know, we are, we've pivoted to have more of an ESG mindset and like impact and social impact element to it too. So I'm glad to see that sort of intention with the FAA's decision on that to making that more intentional and bring back something better for humanity. So that's really interesting. With Trish being, you know, Houston based and Houston being the space city, I guess I just wanted to wrap up our conversation with your take on Houston's future as a space city. Of course, there are space related companies across the country and the world even, but, you know, how do you see Houston's role in this greater space exploration landscape in the future of space? Do you see us holding on to that title, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask.
Oh yeah. I think we'll be space city forever because of, because of our history and because of the contributions that Johnson Space Center has made towards human spaceflight. But, you know, it's not just reflected in things like our MBA team being called the Rockets. We actually have a whole lot of expertise here that that ends up supporting this new economy. So, for instance, you not just have groups like Trish that exist here based out of Baylor College of Medicine and work with Johnson Space Center, but you also have this emerging opportunity with the spaceport here in Houston. It's a design that I don't know is fully available yet, but it's an effort being made, I think, that would be supported by the city that may involve some area around Ellington Field, and that might create something like a spaceport. You're seeing a number of spaceports in different areas across the country. I think there is some kind of support for that from a governmental basis. But I think you're going to see the Houston one be a really ambitious effort with some good support from a major metropolitan area with a long history of space. So, you know, keep an eye out for that. I think that's going to be one of the key things that helps us. You also have companies like Axiom Space, you know, which is taking over the International Space Station, I think, past 2028. Axiom Space is a Houston-based company with great leadership, and they are helping to establish a lot of the standards for a lot of the flights that are going to be longer duration ISS-based flights. And so, you know, we're really excited about, you know, the progress they're making, and just as we are, you know, any of the carriers that are pushing boundaries, but obviously Axiom Space being here in Houston, they are contributing, and we want to continue to see them grow as leaders. You also have an investment community here. So you have groups like Space Fund that that are investing in a wide variety of technologies and companies that are also working on getting to space. So Houston has not just the heritage, but also it has the people, and it looks like it has an eye on the future. So as far as a place to be, you know, this is has to be one of the top places in the country as far as the future of space, space travel, space health, technologies. And so we'll continue to support those efforts and look for other folks here in Houston that are doing the same.
Absolutely. There's so many moving parts, literally and figuratively, to space. Mm-hmm. So Houston having this role on the human side of space, which includes health, of course, is really interesting. And I'm glad to see, I'm glad to hear that's something you see going forward. But yeah, thank you so much for your time today. I love talking about space. This is always so interesting to get to see what's happening on the research side of things and the future of space. So I really appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you. Have very much enjoyed it. Looking forward to anybody that out there that may have an interest in working with us on space health. You can reach out to us at spacehealth-info@bcm.edu. And congratulations on continuing to push this discussion. We're very excited about everything you're doing as well.
Thanks. I love talking about space.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.